Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots. Hello and welcome to Pod Shots. I am your host, Eric Williams, and on today's episode, we are taking a look at the 1997 Japanese film, Cure. The film stars Koji Yakusho and Masato Hagiwara, and was written and directed by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest Mr. Zach Krusey.
Hello.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. Mr. Krusey, what are you drinking this evening?
I'm drinking Dogfish Head's 60-minute IPA.
Oh, you son of a bitch. See, we don't get that in Nebraska.
Yeah, well, I bought this on sale.
Mm-hmm.
And it tastes a little funky. So I'm guessing it's probably been sitting on the shelf at the Meijer for a little while, and that's why it's on sale. And I mean, it's not bad. It's still a good beer, but it's just not as good as it normally is.
I have, in my very limited travels in the last few years, I have been to your neck of the woods, sort of, and had a little Dogfish Head. And that's pretty good, typically.
Yeah. No, the 90-minute is fantastic. The 60-minute is usually very good, too. But they make a lot of great beers.
Yeah. They just need to recycle their product over at the local store, apparently, huh?
Yeah, apparently. Hmm. So I mean, whatever. I mean, I saved like $3 on what it normally would have cost me for a six-pack. So, I mean, who am I to complain, really?
Yeah, really. Okay, well, I'm having something that this is like the second show in a row where I made a poor choice. I'm having Svedka water, which is not super unusual, but I do have I flavored it with I believe it was the berry sangria, and once again, it tastes like cancer. Zach is what I'm telling you. It's the most artificial tasting thing I think I've ever had. It's just really like, you know, it's like that after you taste it, like really, ugh.
Yeah.
Not great.
That's so,
I don't know. I figured, you know, I put a little less in it last time, and I thought maybe that was going to be the trick, and it was a different flavor, but no, still disappointing. Okay, before we get into our discussion, I should mention that Audible is still offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. For 30-day trial membership, I should say. Just go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and choose from over 180,000 audio programs, download a title for free, and start listening. It's that easy. So go to audibletrial.com/plainlabelpodcast and get started today. And with that, we are ready to kick off our discussion of the 1997 film Cure.
に僕が友子を殺しました。あの時は娘は当然だと思ったんです。俺さ、成田の話は聞いた。女は男よりも片男泣きもんだ。頭の行かれた女房がいたんじゃ刑事も片足だな。
And the IMDb plot synopsis of the film goes like this. A wave of gruesome murders is sweeping Tokyo. The only connection is a bloody X carved into the neck of each of the victims. In each case, the murderer is found near the victim and remembers nothing of the crime. Detective Takabe and psychologist Sakuma are called in to figure out the connection, but their investigation goes nowhere. An odd young man is arrested near the scene of the latest murder, who has a strange effect on everyone who comes into contact with him. Detective Takabe starts a series of interrogations to determine the man's connection with the killings. Okay, and that's fairly straightforward. That one's not too bad. Sometimes, especially for the foreign film, some of the plot synopsis can just be like, and then he went here, and then he did this, and then he found the clue he was looking for, and everything was solved. So I was glad that that one kind of left it a little bit ambiguous as to how things end there. Right. So getting into a little bit of history, this is a first watch for both of us, right?
Yep.
And it was selected because actually it was the impetus was our mutual friend Mr. Ben Teed had said, hey, let's do Inside Llewyn Davis. It's a Criterion film, and a lot of those are on Hulu. And I was like, yep. Oh shit. Well, maybe I should look at other films that are on Hulu. So I gave you like a list of three or four or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had determined that this one was more was closest to your sensibilities, basically, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. This was totally up my alley.
Okay. So what did you think of it?
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And I watched it all the way through, and then I watched parts of it twice.
Mm.
Because I didn't, the first time I watched it, they just weren't like, with the kids and stuff around, it just wasn't like optimal, movie viewing, you know, it wasn't the optimal movie viewing experience. So I went back and watched a few parts again. I thought it was fantastic in a really wonderfully weird and unsettling way.
Yeah, this was a film where, you know, generally, if you get to a Criterion film, it's going to be of high quality, at least. You know, it's going to be, most people seem to enjoy it, most movie people. And so I had kind of high expectations for it, and I thought that it was really good. I feel like I should watch it again, because I think that so much of it, I was like, what am I watching a little bit? Like, especially once we get toward the third act,
mm-hmm.
like, what actually is going on? Like, am I following this or not? And I kept thinking, and we'll get into this later, but I kept thinking that the detective's wife was involved, like had something to do with something, with the killings, or had, I think my speculation was that she had got away from that killer somehow and was still kind of damaged or something. And I just kind of, I don't know if I was expecting a nice and neat little bow on everything or mm-hmm. what, but I just was struck with that theory so early on. I just kind of was hanging on to it. And then when it didn't really amount to what I thought it was going to, I was kind of like, wait a minute. Maybe I shouldn't have been putting this on the movie the entire time, and I should have just watched it. But no, I did really enjoy the film. What were some of the highlights for you?
The first couple of murders were really interesting and hooked me pretty well. I really liked those. And I liked watching, I liked not just seeing the early murders, but I liked the way that the film sort of structured the narrative around the murders.
Mm-hmm.
So like in the beginning, we just see the dead bodies, you know, and they've got the X sort of, you know, slashed into their throats. And we know that this has been happening for some time. So I liked that setup and then the opportunity to sort of unravel how these murders are happening, right? Because we don't actually see most of the other murders, right? We just see the aftermaths of them. We don't see them being committed. It's just sort of hinted at, you know, the reason that they're committed. So I really like the way that the film sort of set us up and sort of guided us through that and allowed us to sort of, be one step ahead of the detective all the time, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're figuring it out just before he does, and then he sort of pieces it all together. So I thought that was really fantastic, and I liked the way that played out. And I also, I think the biggest thing for me, though, was not just that, but the ending of the film, too, was really excellent and wonderfully ambiguous, because it's kind of hard to say definitively whether or not that, you know, Detective Takabe, he is the, you know, he's replaced, you know, the ostensible mastermind behind all of these, serial murders. Mm-hmm. So I really thought that was intriguing too.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if you saw this also, but apparently they did shoot an alternate ending where it actually shows the waitress killing someone.
Oh, no, I didn't know that, and I didn't see that.
Yeah, I'm glad that she just has a knife, and it's pretty clear what she's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't feel like that would have fit in with the rest of the film if it would have gone for something gory right at the end.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I agree. I wouldn't have wanted to see that. I feel like that would have spoiled the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the whole movie, I mean, they've set us up where they're not going to show us. They're just going to give us these hints as to what's happening, and they're going to leave it, I mean, enough where we can say definitively that it is this, but visually it's ambiguous as to whether that actually happens. We never see it happen. We just sort of intuit that it happens.
Yeah,
right?
The only time that we actually do see something happening is when we see the psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
When she is kind of just finished and she's kind of playing with one of the victim's faces.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, taking the face off, basically. And I'm like, oh my God. Because we had gone so far into the movie so far and it wasn't showing anything. And then all of a sudden it was this horrific sequence. And I was like, whoa, that is intense. To where if the whole movie had been like that, it wouldn't have really had that much of an impact. So I really appreciated that. I think that was my favorite bit was the killer and her and their sequence and their back and forth. Because that one was the one that was really kind of, I don't know if that was I think that was the first like real elaborate one that we watched from the beginning, of him and the hypnosis and all of that through sort of the end, because the rest of them we wouldn't really see as much. Like it would just be shorter conversations, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Right.
And yeah, so that one was good.
Yeah, no, that's, I agree. That's the one where, I mean, it's sort of, you know, alleviates the viewer of any doubt as to what's happening. But even then, I mean, it's still the conversation. I mean, I don't recall anything direct in that conversation that causes her to, you know, cut off that guy's face, right? There's not like a direct command. And he never creates that direct command. So you're still left to wonder, like, how is he, you know, able to put all of these, you know, hypnotic suggestions into people's brains, if he is this hypnotist that's doing these things, right? If it's a apparently natural or you know, at least quasi-natural explanation rather than something supernatural where, I mean, where they keep saying at the beginning, you know, the devil made him do it, that sort of thing. I mean, you don't really get to say definitively that it is one way or the other, even in that part, right?
Yeah, the part that where they looked like they were venturing into a little supernatural is when we had the monkey wrapped around the shower,
mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. I don't know that. I mean, I get the symbol of the monkey and how it comes into effect later, but I was like, what is that supposed to do? Like, what is that? Are we venturing into supernatural or are we not? Is it just kind of like a voodoo sort of situation, or, you know? And that was, I don't know if I was struggling with that bit, but I was kind of like, that's a little unclear to me. And I feel like I should understand it more than I do. It's kind of what I was thinking.
So yeah, I had a similar feeling about that though. But again, I mean, it's like, I kind of liked that I didn't know, and I kind of liked that it made me feel uncomfortable and weird.
Yeah, it is a strange film in that it's in the vein of a lot of other films, but it does things kind of the opposite of what most of them do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we are not clear on how he's doing this, why he's doing this. I was unclear if he was pretending to not know all of the things when they were asking him his name and his address and all of that. Like, I was like, does he actually not know? Or is this a guy that is just so smart that he can pretend, you know, and he's just fooling everyone? And
right.
I just thought that was it was handled in a lot more intelligent way than a lot of your typical Hollywood murder mysteries might be.
Yeah.
So I thought that was good. What about? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, so here you go. So thanks to the magic of the internet.
Yes.
I just Googled monkeys in Japanese and Chinese culture.
Uh huh.
And like our ostensible sort of killer there, Mr. Miyami,
mm-hmm.
the monkey is a trickster god.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a cultural thing that doesn't make as much sense to me then, I guess.
Yeah, but it makes perfect sense for the film and perfect sense for the character who's a sort of trickster character who doesn't, you know, who is literally tricking people into doing stuff, but is also mysterious and always hiding behind, you know, facades and that sort of thing.
Sure, sure. Well, that, yeah. I mean, that works out great. Then I'm sure that played really big in Japan, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh shit, of course it's the monkey. It makes total sense to where me as an ignorant American, I'm watching it, I was like, yeah, there's this dried monkey on the shower. Like, what does that have to do with anything? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of wondered, but I didn't know, and I didn't bother to look it up until just now. But yeah, they're trickster figures. So
sure.
There you
okay.
go.
Some of the things that I really appreciated was I was glad after I got over being hung up on the wife being involved in this, or like got away from the killer. Like once I got away from that potential storyline that was at least going on in my mind, I was glad to think about this detective as being a real guy and having actual problems at home. And having mm-hmm. things that were separate, but, you know, he would bring his work home sort of like when we get to the sequence with her being, or with her in the kitchen where he thinks that she's hung herself or hanged herself. And so I was glad to see that he wasn't just like average Joe detective, that he had other things also that was going on that led to him having sort of a shorter fuse with the killer when he couldn't figure out exactly what was happening. And I just thought that it added a little bit to the film and to that character specifically.
Yeah, no, I agree. And especially since, you know, in something like this, you almost expect the detective to have some sort of like superhuman ability to be ultimately rational at all times and crack this irrational person, you know? But meanwhile, I mean, he deals with irrationality all the time and behaves irrationally at points. So, yeah, no, I like that too. And sort of shows like the cracks in the facade of what is and is not rational, you know?
Yeah. What did you think about the way that the film looked?
You know, I'm not really sure. I actually had that thought while I was watching it. And I don't think it's, I don't know how I feel about the way it was shot, mm-hmm. but in terms of like the aesthetic, I mean, it looked like it was shot in, you know, the late 90s.
Right. I mean, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way you could mistake it for any other era. I mean, it is, you know, 1996, 1997 encapsulated in film form. Mm-hmm. Although I was surprised that it felt not grainy, but it just felt like it was gray. Like much grayer than I would have expected a film from that period, but maybe that's just sort of me misremembering movies from the era or something, or only watching specific kinds. I don't know, but I mean, all the technology and everything looked like it was, you know, straight out of that period, straight out of my sophomore year of high school.
Oh sure, I thought it was. It looked really similar to me as a let's try to go in a David Fincher kind of way. That's kind of the way that I took it, because it was like a little Seven-ish in the way that it just was lit and shot and that kind of thing. One of the things that I did think was impressive, or one of the things that was startling, I guess, kind of along the lines of the woman who's, you know, shockingly peeling away a face. But I liked when we have the sort of mesmer psychologist talk, and we have these sort of little cut scenes when he's in the car, and it's kind of his either memory or like a vision or something. And it's like these really quick sort of just little blips that are in and out of the movie that makes him run on home and then see his wife, who he thinks has hanged herself in the kitchen, and then turns out that she actually hasn't. And I really liked that, because up until then it was really kind of a straightforward hypnotist killer, kind of a, like, here's what we're going to do, is it's a hypnotist killer, and this is what we're going with. But then when we had that little bit of visual interest in there, I was like, oh, okay, well, I don't really know what this movie's going to go for with the rest of the film, because it was surprising me a little bit more than I had given it credit for up until that point, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then the hanging thing really was a shocker for me, because he comes home and he sees his wife who's had these mental issues, and he's trying to solve this case and work with her, and She just kind of, like, she can't really remember what's going on. Is that kind of the situation? Like, she has short-term memory loss or something, or she gets lost.
Yeah, she has some sort of amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was so similar. Like, I don't know. I thought it was so similar to what the killer had, or at least was pretending to have, that I was like, well, this has got to be connected somehow. But so she has this amnesia, and they're going to go on this trip, and she doesn't really want him to go, and she forgets to, you know, cook food, which I was guessing that was a steak that wasn't cooked. And I was like, well, I mean, that's not that weird for uncooked food, right? Like, he's just having steak tartare, but he was really pissed about it. But he comes home and he finds her and he thinks that she's dead. And I was so glad not to see a no, you know, or that sort of reaction. And it did strike me a little bit of, my favorite Korean film of Old Boy, where there's like a drop to your knees and just the sort of look of anguish on his face.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, this guy is nailing this take right now, right? Right? That's what I'm watching, and I'm seeing him do this. And then it cuts and she's fine. And I was really surprised when she was okay. And, I was like, oh man, this is fitting right in. Like, she, you know, now he's really going to be, after him, because I think it was, soon, it was like right before that was when they were in the interrogation room, I believe, when he was in isolation.
Yeah.
And he was asking about his wife, and that's kind of what he does, is he's like, who are you? And that's kind of his way in. And so I was like, oh shit, you know, he got to the wife somehow and all of this. And then no, it turns out not really to be. And I was really kind of shocked by that.
Yeah. I thought that scene was surprising to me. Because I thought that she had really done it too, you know. I didn't realize that it was a hallucination. And I'm glad for that, but, they didn't telegraph that at all. So,
right.
which I was glad for. And speaking of hangings too, and not to skip too far ahead, but what did you think about the psychiatrist that he was working with, that hanging scene?
Okay, so it's Sakuma, right?
Right, Sakuma, right.
And he's having problems. He wrote he scrawls the X on his, in his room or at his mm-hmm. house. And I'm like, okay, this guy definitely is going to be the next one to kill somebody. And, I don't know. I guess I was having a little bit of trouble figuring out what I was supposed to think during that, because I was like, okay, does he know enough that he's sort of hooked by this guy to where he's just going to kill himself now? Or is the thing that he's supposed to do is the suggestion that he's supposed to kill himself? Like, I don't know. I was a little bit lost on that.
Well, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I recall correctly, Takabe, the detective, kind of corners him, right?
Yes, yes.
And then there's a sort of quick cutaway. I kind of was left wondering whether or not Takabe killed him.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, and especially the way that the rest of the film progresses.
Right, because they don't find his body right away. I mean, they find it sometime later. So it's not really clear. I mean, it's ruled a suicide, but it's not really clear whether or not he killed himself.
Mm.
Right? Like, we don't see him kill himself. We don't see anyone else go in and out. And the last person to see him alive is Takabe.
Sure.
While all this weird shit is going down with, you know, trying to scratch the X on the wall. And so I kind of wondered if that was a turning point for Takabe, which to me made sense on a second viewing of the ending, where, you know, if Takabe is taking the place of this mesmerist, this hypnotist killer, and causes that waitress to kill her boss.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, it just, I don't know, those two events, I mean, seem to work together.
Yeah, it does.
If one or both of those things has happened, then it makes sense for Takabe to have killed the psychiatrist. I can never remember his name, Sakumi?
Sakuma.
Sakuma.
Yeah, anyway. I guess I don't know. That sequence, I felt like the beginning of the film I was with, and I, you know, it took me a little bit to kind of get what we were doing with the, I think it was specifically when we were on the beach and we had that school teacher and we had like people jumping out of windows and people, you know, we hear that the school teacher's wife has the big X on her. And I was just kind of, I don't know, I was having a little bit of trouble following at the very beginning of it, I felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Then once we got into the second act, I was like, okay, I'm totally on board. Like, I'm getting it. Everything's working great. And we get to the third act, and we had the almost hanging. We had the sort of, like the cloud, the sort of smoke in the corner kind of thing that turns into Takabi, or at least mm-hmm. his form. And I was like, I don't know if I'm getting this. Like, I'm starting to lose the grasp a little. I'm starting to lose it a little bit. And then we get to the end and I'm like, oh, that was awesome. Like, I really enjoyed the way that it ended. So right. I was just kind of like, I don't know. I was a little roller coaster-like. So that's why I feel like I should view it again, because I don't know that I fully got everything that I was supposed to. Like, I feel like I missed it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt like that too. That's why I went back and watched some of those scenes twice. And maybe I should have just watched the whole movie twice, but again, I guess now that we know that that monkey figure is sort of like a trickster god type, I think it might be useful to know more or background on that.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I feel like that's sort of like something that sort of like ties it all together and makes it work.
Well, if he's a trickster god, does that mean that the guy, like, I don't know, this is a pretty elementary question, but does that mean that the guy has been actually just pretending the entire time, or does he actually not have short-term memory?
Oh, the Miami?
The original, yeah, Miami.
Yeah, oh, I don't think he has short-term memory loss at all.
Okay, so he's just a skilled trick. He's a skilled guy like that.
Yeah, I think what he's doing is, because he keeps using the, like, water, and it keeps the same questions over and over again, and then water and that flame, right? So he keeps using like this combination of physical and oral and visual tactics to sort of provide the kind of hypnotic suggestion that his, you know, ostensible victims need, right? And he keeps doing those same things over and over and over again. So I don't think, and he's doing it on purpose. And he only asks the same questions over and over again. Right? So I think I think he knows exactly what he's doing. And I think we get a glimpse into that when they're at that sort of police inquest.
Yeah.
And he turns to Takabi and he starts talking to him. And even before that, when they're in the interrogation room at the insane asylum or whatever, where he says, "You're amazing because you're not," you know, he doesn't say, he says you're amazing, but the implication is that you're amazing because I can't get to you.
Right, right.
And then he sort of continues that during the inquest. Mm-hmm. Right. So because he knows that he can't get to Takabi, I think that sort of lets us know that, or clues us into the fact that he doesn't have short-term memory loss at all. He's just using these things as a means to control people.
Yeah, so I felt like when he was saying that he was amazing and then he basically couldn't hypnotize him, I guess I wasn't clear as to if he was saying that because he couldn't get to him or because he had sort of the same capacity, like he could sort of be the same guy or could sort of be not like a brother in arms sort of thing, but they could sort of understand each other or things could be, you know, transferred to the detective. Later mm-hmm. or something. Like, I didn't know if it was sort of like a kindred spirit or what exactly.
Yeah, I thought they were sort of like equal opposites, right?
Mm, sure. Okay.
I mean, that's how I read it.
Yeah, that makes a little bit more sense. Since we're in this end here, so what did you think about when we have it's Sukuma that goes into that room, yeah?
Yes.
And then we have just this sort of, I mean, it just looks like a dark corner. And it's held on there for a little bit, and then it takes a form, and it's Takabi. Was that a surprising moment for you? Or what did you think when you saw that?
Yeah. I mean, but it turns out that's a hallucination, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was really surprised by that. And I think the thing that sort of, like, jumped out to me the most about that is not just that that Takabi was there, like in the shadows, or he's like that smoke or mist or whatever. But then that is linked to that particular room and to the shower, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff. So I kind of got, and again, it's just another thing that made me think that there's something else going on with Takabi by the end, and that and that second hanging, right? Like, there's just something weird going on with this guy. And that was sort of the way that the film wanted us to sort of put those pieces together.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm not doing as good of a job as I should in putting the pieces together, but I think that that's what intrigues me about the film and makes me want to watch it again.
Yeah.
I feel like if this was some Hollywood version, you would see, you know, a spirit going from the original killer into Takabi toward the end, or you would see some kind of very clear line from one to the other, and everything would be very crystal clear, and that would lose some of the emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I do really like the end bit where I guess I don't know if Takabi is has become the new version of this yet or not, but it's when they are at the it's where their final sequence together is anyway, and he just shoots the shit out of him. Mm-hmm. I mean the guy's trying to play the game with him again, and he's a good distance away, and Takabi's all down, it looks like, and he just kind of turns around and shoots him, and then walks up and just shoots the hell out of him. like really shoots him. Like, not messing around whatsoever.
Yeah,
so I didn't know if that was an actual transformation to where he was now a bad guy that we find out in the sort of waitress sequence, or if he was just killing him as the police officer. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a good question. But, I mean, it's another instance, though, of, like, him losing control,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. When dealing with this guy. I mean, otherwise he's always in control, right? And then he deals with this person who's more in control than he is. And he like just loses his shit on him.
So, yes.
So, I mean, I don't know quite what to make of that other than just sort of, you know, like it's just sort of highlighting the differences between the two. Like Miami probably wouldn't have done that to him, right?
Sure. He
would have either gotten someone else to do it or would have found, you know, some sort of means where the person committing the act is sane and knows what they're doing, whereas Takabi doesn't seem sane in that moment, right?
Right.
A sane person doesn't unload an entire magazine into somebody who's clearly already dead.
Especially in the face, it seemed like. It seemed like it was really in the upper part of him.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to make, like I said, I don't know what to make of that other than it's just another instance of him completely losing control.
Yeah, one of the things that I was really glad to not see, that again, I feel like if this was an American version, we would see, is I'm glad that we didn't really have much in terms of motivation from the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was no, he was beaten as a child, or he's some sort of Satanist that we see him practicing or something, or, you know, we don't see him like his journey becoming this trickster god or anything like that. He just is, like, as we already begin the film.
Yeah, he's a force of nature, right?
Yeah, and I like that. I'm just so tired of all of, you know, spending half of a film setting up a character. Like, just give me the character already.
Yeah. Well, you know, and they make reference to that, like, throughout the early part of the film, like, throughout most of the first act, Sukuma keeps saying, like, you know, most of these crimes don't have any reason at all. There is no reason for any of this. While Takabe is trying to find the reason, it turns out there's not one. So I really like that too. I don't really care if the killer was like molested as a kid or whatever.
That's not the point of the film, right?
Right, exactly.
One of the other sequences that I really enjoyed was with the police detective, or the police just regular officer, I guess he was.
Mm-hmm.
And we have when he's under hypnosis and they're kind of letting him do what he's programmed to do.
Yeah.
To the other security guard there. And he's, you know, dragging, I don't know if he was like dragging his thumb or what he was dragging across the guy in the big X, but that was the sequence that was really the most disturbing to me, I thought, because I was like, holy shit. Like, this guy, you know, I guess it was one of the few times where we actually saw someone doing what they'd been programmed to do. Like, we actually were physically seeing it.
Right.
And so that was something that I really thought was striking and kind of, disturbing.
Yeah. And the guy's so, I mean, like his demeanor while he does it is so relaxed. And I think that's like, for me, like that amplifies like how unsettling that whole scene is.
Mm-hmm.
He's having a conversation with him. The guy turns his back, then he shoots him and then just hangs around and walks inside. So, all right, well, bye.
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead.
No, that was it.
Oh, okay. One of the, since it is a Criterion film, you know, you have a few people that will say some really lavish things about the movie, but Martin Scorsese says that this was Kurosawa's most terrifying movie, which, I don't know, I guess I thought it was more terrifying in like a social aspect, you know, to where someone would be able to control people.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to it being like a horror film, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't read it as a horror film.
No. And that's something that you do find a little bit of if you look up this film. Like a lot of people will label it a horror film.
Hmm.
And it's here in on the Wikipedia, which is always right, says Tom Mess, I guess, of Midnight Eye describes the film as a horror film in the purest sense of the word, which I guess to me makes it seem like more horrific as opposed to like a jump scare and blood and guts kind of a horror film.
Hmm.
I guess would be the way that I took it. And then Bong Joon-ho, who did Snowpiercer and a few other films that we've covered on this show, he listed this as one of the greatest films of all time in his opinion. I don't know that I'd be able to make that kind of a jump, but I do enjoy the film.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of the greatest films ever made, but but I really, really like this. And I liked it because it was because of its unusual nature. And I think, and just being, and sort of spitballing on that, I think the thing that is perhaps not unusual about it in terms of, you know, contemporary, you know, 20th century narratives is interesting in terms of like the world of film, at least to like an American audience, is like how much it really plays with, you know, rationality. I know I said that, sort of hinted that before, but I mean, that's, everyone's just sort of teetering on the brink of doing something irrational for reasons beyond his or her control throughout this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
While meanwhile being diagnosed as completely sane, even though they've done an insane thing, right? So it sort of forces us to ask questions about rationality and what we sort of designate as, you know, thoughtful, logical, reasonable behavior in a world where these things happen, right? The way that we cope with them. So I think there's some interesting sort of social commentary in there. I'm not 100% certain what it is, but I think that it centers around those ideas, right? Like, there is no answer. There is no sort of clean way to fix this, right? Takabe can't fix his wife. These people kill for reasons that are beyond their control, even though they seem perfectly normal.
Mm-hmm.
Miami has no real motive for doing these things other than just to see them happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there's just a lot going on there that make it really, a worthwhile film.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they kind of slide in there is that they mention that people under hypnosis still won't do something that they wouldn't have done anyway.
Right.
And I think that does add to your social commentary, to where it's sort of telling us that we're all capable of doing terrible things to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That all we need to do is either have the right push or the right sort of suggestion that, yeah, this is what you should do. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll go tear this person's throat up or whatever.
Well, and especially in a world that's sort of governed by order, right? And like, mm-hmm. arbitrary rules, right? I mean, who decides what is real and not real? Who decides what is acceptable and not acceptable? We're just all kind of constantly like on the brink,
mm-hmm.
right? Between those two spaces, and like you're saying, I mean, Miami comes along and just pushes his victims into that other space.
Well, and I do think it is interesting that the people that he chooses to become murderers are the people that have the most regimented and strict lives, mm-hmm. typically.
Right.
You know, it's a school teacher, it's a police officer, it's a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
It's not just some drunk at the bar or something.
No, yeah, it's not people who are already on the margins of society. I mean, yeah. These are the people that are supposed to be respected members of society. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like this is one that I definitely do need to watch again. I feel like the more times I would watch it, the more I would sort of appreciate it. I think it's that mm-hmm. kind of a movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you got anything else there, Mr. Krusey?
When I saw the name of the director, this is really not of too much value, but when I saw the name of the director, I got excited because I thought maybe he was related to Akira Kurosawa. Yeah. He's not.
Right.
He's not at all.
I know. I mentioned the Kurosawa, and I'm like, no, this guy's a little more, you know, this is a little more current.
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe he was like some sort of relation, like a nephew or a son or, you know.
Oh, no, I definitely thought the same thing, especially when, you know, it's written and directed by him, and I'm like, oh, okay, maybe this is related in some way.
Yeah.
But no. That is funny, though, that I thought the same. So there you go. All right, well, that was the extent of my notes. If you don't have anything else either, Mr. Krusey, I think we could wrap this one up.
No, I don't think so, but I just want to just thank you for bringing this to my attention, because this is a really excellent film.
Yeah, and, I was glad to watch it, too.
And besides being in sort of like that sort of crime fiction thriller wheelhouse that I have, like, it really is just like everything that I kind of look for and just sort of like books and movies and that sort of thing anymore. Just something bizarre that's going to challenge me. And I think that this was a great film for that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be challenged.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I agree. Like we already mentioned, it is on Hulu. You know, it is among the various Criterion films on there. It is not a film that a lot of people really talk about. It doesn't seem like, at least in the US, because there's not a ton of information really on the film that I could find. It was, it wasn't one of the imports into the U.S. that made a huge impact or anything like that. It didn't come out until July of 2001, actually, in the U.S. So,
oh, wow.
It's quite a delay there. And I'm frankly a little bit surprised that no one's reached and tried to redo this in the States.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised by that too, but I'm also glad, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Really. Me too, yeah.
Leave this alone.
That's right.
You're already fucked up, old boy.
Oh, jeez, yes. Whew. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page and an Instagram account. Just look for Plain Label Podcast, and you'll find us there. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and search for our wish list. It's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other goodies in case you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I do want to thank Mr. Krusey once again for coming on and discussing another film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they do so?
All over the internet. My handle on Twitter, Instagram, the Facebook, what else do I use? I don't know, all of the social medias that I use. It's @ZachKrusey, ZackKrusey. You can always find me there, and I'm always easy to get a hold of, so.
Well, there you go. All right, well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.